This week on KPBS Roundtable, we discuss recent controversies involving San Diego libraries and censorship.
Efforts to censor books, the availability of certain books in libraries, has jumped dramatically.
And we take a look at an effort to bring a national monument to the Imperial Valley.
After colonization, this land has actually really long served residents of color. The Imperial and Coachella Valleys are both home to many large Latino communities.
That and our weekly roundup coming up next on Roundtable. Few public spaces welcome strangers quite like public libraries. Here's how Adrienne Peterson from the Rancho Penasquitos Library put it.
You don't have to pay to come to the library. The library is here for everybody. Doesn't matter who you are, rich or poor, educated, whatever your religious beliefs are. We don't judge. We don't tell you what to read.
But in recent years, libraries have faced controversies leading to protests and book bans, with some of them happening in and around San Diego. KPBS's Amitha Sharma has been taking a closer look at libraries and how they've been impacted by recent cultural battles and divides. Amitha, welcome back to Roundtable.
Oh, it's good to be here, Scott.
So you've done some great reporting recently on libraries and their intersection with censorship and broader cultural battles. But before we jump in, what drew you to these stories? Why libraries?
Sort of by default, I had been assigned to do a story on Democracy Day, and we didn't quite know how to come at it. We didn't want to do your run-of-the-mill Democracy Day story, how it started, you know, why we mark it. So we ended up thinking we should do a story on how democracy is faring in San Diego County. Once we decided that, we had to figure out some yardsticks. How do we measure this? So we arbitrarily picked these yardsticks. So we came up with threats to elected officials. Are they going up? Are they going down? We wanted to look at voting. We wanted to look at local news coverage. And we wanted to look at censorship. And where does censorship happen? It happens at libraries.
Well, let's jump in to Rancho Penasquitos Library. Your latest story was about some of the issues that are popping up here. What's been happening? Catch us up.
Well, last June, during Pride Month, two women checked out all the books at a Pride display at Rancho Penasquitos Library. And then they sent an email to the library branch manager saying that, look, we've checked out all your books, and we're not going to return them until you remove the display.
And it's remarkable. What happened from there? What was the public's response?
Well, you know, all of this is unintended, obviously. Not choreographed at all. But the public pulled a G move. I mean, they one-upped these two women. They found out about it. I think there was some press coverage. And so they learned what books had been on the display, and they bought the books. People in droves, not just from Rancho Penasquitos, across the country, all over the world. They bought the books. They bought more books with LGBTQ themes, you know, to add to Rancho Penasquitos' library collection on this topic. And they sent them, they gifted them to the library. Not only that, they ended up donating tens of thousands of dollars to the library.
That's a lot of attention for, you know, a pretty small public library. You know, most people think of the job of librarian, you know, memorize the Dewey Decimal System, make some book recommendations. But the job of the librarian has evolved over time, especially in recent years. You know, tell us about how that's changed. But I guess, you know, maybe put it in terms of this experience at Rancho Penasquitos. You know, how did the librarians handle this situation?
You know, that is a really, really good question. I think that this is one of those rare situations where censorship is concerned, where attempted censorship is concerned, where they didn't have to handle it. They really didn't have to do anything. As soon as word got out, the public handled it. People handled it. They made their views known in a gigantic way about whether they will tolerate censorship, and they're not going to tolerate it. So I think the librarians unwittingly could basically just sit back and say, oh, okay. And in the end, you know, those two women, they returned those books.
The situation in Rancho Penasquitos is not unique, right? It's happening in libraries across the country. You mentioned the Pride display in Rancho Penasquitos. What topics or types of books, more broadly, tend to trigger these calls for book removals or censorship?
So books on race tend to be the targets of banning efforts. There's a book called Stamped from the Beginning. Books on LGBTQ subjects also receive a lot of attention from parents, members of the community who think that not everybody should have access to that kind of material. There's a book called All Boys Aren't Blue. And you talked about censorship. You know, censorship across this country, or efforts to censor books, the availability of certain books in libraries, has jumped dramatically. Last year, in the first 8 months, there were something like 700 challenges to 2,000 books. That was a 20% jump over the previous year, 2022. And that year, there were record attempts at censorship.
Let me ask you, so this situation in Rancho Penasquitos, it had the opposite effect. Like you said, a lot of times the push to remove a book, censor a book, will have a whiplash in the other direction. But have there been any instances in San Diego or the region where the efforts to try to get a book banned or removed or maybe moved to a different part of the library have been successful? Do you know of any instances?
I don't really. And I think a person's personal discontent with a particular book is not always expressed through an organized process. Like, they may not, you know, fill out a form to file a formal complaint. That said, I mean, there's some funny instances that I've heard of where, you know, people will send these messages to librarians saying, you know, why do you have this book? Or they'll just go to the desk and ask them, why do you have this book? Why is this necessary? And some people will take the books and hide them. They'll put them in other sections of the library, or they'll just put the books face down. It's kind of a little bit of passive aggressiveness. So people don't register their dissatisfaction with some of this material in the same way.
Sort of guerrilla efforts at censorship,
right.
I guess you could call
Who
it.
Who knew that the library was the scene of this kind of activity?
I want to step back a little bit. This is maybe more of a personal question, but I'm curious, what role have libraries in general played in your life? Did you go to them as a kid? Did you go to them when you were a student in college?
Well, libraries have played a massive role in my life. Between the Riverside Public Library, which was built in 1903, the libraries at school, K through 12, and the UC Riverside Library, my mom was a grad student at UC Riverside. Between those three areas where I could tap into a library, I probably went to the library every single day when I was a child. So I'd say mostly in elementary school. And then, you know, in high school, I spent time in the school library, I think pretty much every single day. Then in college, same thing. After college, not so much. When I had my daughter, then I was back at the library two or three times a week. In the course of this coverage, I've almost fallen in love with libraries all over again. And it's for that same reason that I think is very universal. It's the sense that you get when you go into a library. It's quiet. It's still. There are all these books. There's a feeling of unlimited possibility of learning. And I was reading a little bit about Ben Franklin, who, with his friends, back in 1731, started the country's first library. And it started off with him. Well, him and his friends loved books, but books were so expensive. In fact, Ben Franklin stopped eating meat because meat was expensive. So he wanted to save money to buy books. He was eating lots of vegetables and lots of grains. And then he and his friends came up with this idea of pooling their money and buying the books that they wanted to read, and then starting a subscription service. And in order to subscribe to a book, in order to check out a book, you had to pay for the value of the book, and you wouldn't get your money until you'd returned your book.
That's a pretty, I actually didn't know that story. That's pretty amazing.
It's fascinating. But it's that same thirst, you know, for knowledge that drove him and his friends to do that. And I love the smell of libraries, you know, and it's almost the same in every library. Like you walk in and you think, yeah, this is where it happens.
I think Yankee Candle needs to make a candle with the library
exactly.
smell. I would buy it.
I would too.
I feel like you were giving a lot of love to some of the libraries that you went to growing up. I feel like I need to do the same. Shout out to Noah Webster Public Library in West Hartford, Connecticut.
Oh, wow.
Great library.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I went there, especially in my, you know, in my later teen years, I went there a lot. Let's jump to another story related to libraries that you covered recently. You were reporting in recent weeks on a situation at the public library in Coronado. What's happening there?
Well, there's been this ongoing dispute between the Coronado Public Library and these two women, two moms who live in Coronado. One is married to a current Navy SEAL. Another one is married to a former Navy SEAL. One of the women wanted to do her own story time where she would choose books that were about Christmas from a religious perspective. And she also wanted to do military-themed story times. She asked the library if she could do it, and they said, look, no, we have our library staff do this kind of story time, and also we don't do story times that promote a particular religion. Another woman whom I interviewed, Jessica Tompain, she's the one who's married to a former Navy SEAL, she objected to a particular book that was read at story time during Pride Month. It's called The Rainbow Parade. And she didn't like the illustrations in there. One of the illustrations showed two guys in BDSM gear. And another one showed an illustration of, I think, a naked person walking down the street. So she thought, you know, this is inappropriate. And so she said that she didn't want other books with any kind of graphic images being at eye level for toddlers in the library. She's not saying remove the books. She's saying put them in a place that's clearly delineated. So these women and the library couldn't come to any kind of agreement. They hired a lawyer. The lawyer sent a demand letter asking for certain things, certain policy changes that reflect what the women wanted. As of right now, this lawyer and the city of Coronado are in talks for potential policy changes. I believe I checked in maybe 2 days ago. They haven't reached any kind of agreement just yet.
And so there are multiple kind of threads here. You have the story time issue related to religious stories being told, and then this issue of questions raised over content within books for children. But the situation kind of took a darker turn in recent months. There was a Fox News segment that aired. What happened after that segment was broadcast?
Well, first I should say that the segment cast the city of Coronado. It cast the library as this anti-Christmas, anti-military villain. And library staff were then inundated with messages that appeared to be coming from across the country because Fox News is national. And some of the comments were hostile, they were vile, and then some were threatening. So there was one comment, just to give you a sample of the tone, one comment that said, woke liberals have the lowest intellect and common sense in society. They are perverted idiots who should not be permitted to live freely in our country. Do us all a favor and pull your head out of your woke, you know what, and do the right thing. And then there were more, even more vile, but this time really alarming ones, like this message that said, will the staff please pour gasoline on their bodies and torch themselves? Now, The key point about all of this, I am told that these messages barely scratched the surface. I mean, they were really flooded with this kind of vitriol.
And again, kind of going back to an idea that I raised earlier, is we don't think of librarians as having to deal with these kinds of messages, being on the front lines of this kind of, you know, vitriolic discourse. We expect them to be people who are members of our community, provide helpful resources. It's just so shocking that they have to deal with that kind of response. Discourse, conversation is one thing. Debate is one thing. Those kinds of responses are a different thing altogether.
Yeah, I mean, it really sunk morale at that library, as you can well understand. And one of the other things it prompted was the city ended up putting security cameras up outside the library because they were obviously worried about the hostility. But getting back to what you said about how the job of libraries or librarians has evolved over the years, you know, I think at their core, the function is the same. I mean, librarians are very knowledgeable. They love books. They love information. And they love helping people discover new worlds of information. But librarians have had to absorb some of society's ills that have developed over the last few decades. And you'll see so many homeless people go into libraries and spend time there. They'll have a few hours of a safe place to be. It's warm, it's comfortable, and, you know, it gives them a little bit of an opportunity to do something that they might find enriching. There's so many kids who come from homes where mom and dad work and they may not be able to afford childcare or after school activities. And so the libraries become the de facto childcare facility for so many kids. And I think that's important to know, that these places are so much more than channels for information. One more example I want to give you, and that is, as you and I have discussed in the newsroom, we're in the midst of a loneliness epidemic. And many elderly people suffer from this, suffer from loneliness. And so a lot of times, people who go to the library and interact with other patrons or librarians, those are the only people that they might interact with that day or that week. And that says a lot.
It says a lot about how these libraries are a cornerstone of the community, cornerstone of the social fabric of, you know, of our communities. Taking a step back, where we started with this was, you know, you were talking about the Democracy Day, the role of libraries in democracy and the role of, you know, the impact of censorship. So how do these stories fit into that bigger picture of the democratic system, the current state of the democratic system, and the pillars that uphold that system?
Well, if you do take a step back and you look at what's happening to libraries, it's a microcosm of the larger attack on democracy. I say that because the core principles that form the bedrock of libraries are the same core principles that form the bedrock of democracy. Freedom of thought, freedom of speech, access to information, inclusivity. The library, as Adrienne Peterson said at the start of our conversation, is for everyone, just as democracy is. It doesn't distinguish between wealth, ethnicity, status, race. And what's more democratic than that?
Amitha Sharma is an investigative reporter with KPBS. Amitha, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
When we come back, we turn our focus to the Imperial Valley in an effort to create a national monument.
I mean, I think you have to start at the beginning. This is all ancestral land of North American indigenous peoples.
That's just ahead on Roundtable. Welcome back to KPBS Roundtable. I'm Scott Rodd. To the east of San Diego lies the Imperial Valley. It's an expanse of land known for its agriculture, its connection to Mexico to the south, and the Salton Sea. A movement is underway to turn part of the Imperial Valley into a national monument. It's an effort to protect a vulnerable desert ecosystem as well as to allow its residents to spend more time in nature. KPBS reporter Corey Suzuki has been reporting on the Imperial Valley and joins us now. Corey, welcome to Roundtable.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me.
So your recent story from the Imperial Valley is ostensibly about the Chuckwalla and an effort to establish a national monument that would protect hundreds of thousands of acres of federally owned land. To start, what is a Chuckwalla and why are environmentalists pushing for protections?
Great question. Well, a Chuckwalla is a desert lizard found in Southern California, other parts of the southwestern United States, and northern Mexico. I've never seen one in person. They're apparently pretty large. They're one of the largest lizards native to North America. And they're also pretty common. There's a lot of habitat where they live, and they're not considered an endangered species or anything like that at this point. But this species is really coming up because there's this coalition of environmental organizations and tribes that's based in the Imperial Coachella Valley region that are proposing this new national monument. It's on the border of Imperial and Riverside County. And a national monument is a big chunk of protected public land. It's kind of like a national park, although there are some slight differences. National monuments are typically shielded from mining and drilling, and they can also open the door for the federal government and tribes to work together to manage the land. And this coalition working on the specific proposal has suggested that they take the name of this lizard and call it the Chuckwalla National Monument.
So I said your reporting was ostensibly about the Chuckwalla, and it is, but the proposed monument has greater significance than that. So, you know, protecting this land, why is there a growing movement around this proposal? And why is this land so significant to the communities in the area?
There's definitely a movement growing around this. A whole bunch of groups are supporting the proposed monument. There are some really big national names like the Sierra Club, the Audubon Society, and the Center for Biological Diversity. You often see those groups supporting movements like this to protect wildlife and natural ecosystems. They're kind of some of the usual suspects. But this coalition is really big, and it ranges from both national organizations to local ones. There are groups like the Consejo de Federaciones Mexicanas, the Council of Mexican Federations in North America, which works to empower Latino immigrants communities in the U.S. and Mexico. There's Latino Outdoors. Their mission is to make nature a safe and inclusive place for Latino communities. And then there are a number of tribal governments supporting this proposal, including the Fort Yuma Quetzon Indian Tribe and the 29 Palms Band of Mission Indians. And then to understand, I think, why this land is so significant to the people who live nearby, I mean, I think you have to start at the beginning. This is all ancestral land of North American indigenous peoples. In the Imperial Valley, that includes the Kumeyaay and Quetzon people. And the land was stolen and colonized first by Spanish missionaries and then by the Mexican government in the mid-1800s, and then later by Gold Rush settlers and farmers. And so the land still has a lot of cultural and physical meaning to the tribes that still live in the valley. And a monument declaration could actually make a really big difference specifically on that front, because the Biden administration has been making this really big push to work together with tribes on managing public lands. Biden's Interior Secretary, Deb Haaland, has really made it a priority to reach some more of these agreements, which basically return some control of these ancestral lands to these tribes. And the Chuckwalla Monument could open the door for more agreements like that with local tribes in the Salton Sea area. And then related to that, the desert is also home to a lot of biodiversity, a lot of plants and animals and ecosystems. One supporter told me that people think of deserts as pretty lifeless, but in a lot of cases, she said, that's really not true at all. There's a lot of life happening. It's just kind of harder to see. In this area specifically, there are sheep and foxes and all kinds of different plants and insects. And that's important partly because biodiversity is crashing globally because of land use and environmental pollution and climate change. And that has all kinds of other cascading effects. So I think supporters would say it's essential to protect biodiversity where we can.
Clearly, there are a lot of issues wrapped up in this, and you just illuminated a lot of them. And there, it seems like so many entry points into, you know, why supporters may come behind this proposal and want to see this national monument. I'm curious, was there one, you know, was there a supporter's story or explanation that stood out to you when you were on the ground reporting as to, you know, why they wanted to see this national monument?
One person who stood out to me was Sandy Hernandez Orellana Barros, who serves as the conservation program manager for COFEM, Consejo de Federaciones Mexicanas. And She grew up in the Coachella Valley, so this is really, I think, a very personal place for her. And that was what she said to me, was that this campaign, it felt very close to home because what it was about was protecting areas where she and her family and her friends were able to go and spend time and to really connect with the place and the wildlife around them. And I think what she would say is that it really brought the conservation movement into a really personal light for her.
Yeah, I mean, when you talk about some of these bigger groups that support it, they have a lot of power to move these things forward. But hearing those personal stories of how people who lived in these areas interacted with the land is always so enlightening and very enriching. You know, I'm curious, historically, you touched on this a bit, but, you know, how have local communities and especially communities of color used and interacted with this land?
That's one thing that really stood out to me about what supporters are emphasizing as they're tackling this proposal to protect this land. Even after colonization, this land has actually really long served residents of color. The Imperial and Coachella Valleys are both home to many large Latino communities. 85% of people in Imperial County actually identify as Latino. So it shouldn't really be surprising that there are lots of people of color who are accessing this land. But historically, discriminatory laws and racial violence have really cut off a lot of communities of color, Black, Asian, Latino communities, from natural areas, and instead, in a lot of cases, really concentrated environmental hazards in their neighborhoods instead. And so that has really left, I think, the movement to enjoy nature and wildlife, the conservation movement, that's really led that to be largely focused on the priorities of white Americans and largely something that's enjoyed and led by white Americans. And so to me, that makes this land and this proposal even more special, because the land that is covered in this proposal, the Chuckwalla National Monument proposal, has been enjoyed by people of color for a long time. In the 1990s, the Federal Bureau of Land Management did a study of the Mecca Hills Preserve, for example, which is part of the proposed monument on the north edge of the Salton Sea. And it found that more than 3/4 of visitors on holiday weekends identified as Latino there. So that was more than 20 years ago.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. I mean, obviously, hearing about the long arc of this development and how, I mean, you talked about going back centuries, but even in the last few decades, I mean, that's pretty interesting. For this story, you were able to go up in a Cessna, a small plane, alongside some advocates who are, you know, pushing for this monument to become a reality. What struck you about the land when you were able to go up in that plane? You know, obviously, when you're up there, it looks quite a bit different than when you're down on the ground. What struck you when you were up there?
Yeah, it's a very different view. It was really the scale that struck me. This is a truly massive proposal, hundreds of thousands of acres of land. There are lots of different trails, different landscapes, hills, mountains, canyons, deserts. It was really beautiful as we flew overhead. The light was kind of hazy, even though the sun was high. And so everything was really lighting up. You could see like the grooves in the land and the ridges and the peaks and the kind of historical trails that have been used by the tribes that have stewarded the land. And something else that also came up was the really stark difference between the land itself and the farmland that borders it. I mean, the Imperial Valley and parts of the Coachella Valley are very engineered places now. They basically take in these dusty desert areas and turn them into this vibrant green farmland by tapping into the Colorado River to the east. And so when you fly over, you see this really sharp contrast between these hills and mountains and kind of rolling canyons and this like sort of jagged high desert landscape. And then all of a sudden it becomes this patchwork of green and blue and farmland that I think anybody who has ever lived or driven through farm country would be familiar with. But it's a really sharp transition. It happens like that.
And what's next for the monument? What sort of support has it gathered so far from politicians? And how far would it have to go if it does become a reality?
There are sort of two ways that a monument designation could happen. It could either happen through an act of Congress, which could set aside those public lands, or it could happen through a presidential executive order, which is sort of one of the things that is slightly unique to a national monument. That's kind of the common way that a national monument is created, through an executive order under something called the Antiquities Act. Now, the White House hasn't really said much on whether Biden has his eye on this proposal in particular, but this whole push for the National Monument has been getting a lot of traction. There have been a bunch of calls for this from local cities and officials, and all the way up to the House of Representatives, where there has been some motion in Congress. U.S. Representative Raul Ruiz, who represents Palm Desert in Riverside County, has introduced a law that could make this monument real. It's still in very early stages, and supporters are actually right now more hopeful about an executive order just because of how slowly Congress moves right now. But this is being considered at the federal level. It's things are in a bit of a holding pattern, but there are also things in motion that could make this monument a reality.
Corey Suzuki covers the Imperial Valley as well as the South Bay for KPBS. Corey, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much, Scott.
When we come back, we'll discuss some more stories that got our attention on this week's Roundup. That's next on Roundtable. Welcome back to Roundtable. It's time now for our weekly roundup of stories we've been following. Joining me is Andrew Bracken. How's it going, Andrew?
Hey, Scott. Pretty good.
All right. So what have you been reading this week? What did you bring?
Well, you know, last week we had Gustavo Solis and Elliot Spaggett from the AP talking about the Migrant Welcome Center that closed last Friday. And kind of as they talked about in that conversation, we have been seeing a lot more effects of that and migrants being dropped off at the transportation centers like we saw before this Migrant Welcome Center opened. The San Diego County Board of Supervisors has, you know, at least taken action to develop a migrant transfer site and shelter sometime in the future. I think the funding's not there. I think the funding is supposed to be coming from the federal government. So there's potentially some planning there to help with those arriving migrants. And then one other kind of note on this sort of border front is the UT's Alexandra Mendoza and Terry Figueroa reported on another death from a fall from the border fence. And that's something that Gustavo has also covered quite a bit, the rise in injuries and the rise in more serious injuries as the border fence wall has gotten higher over the past couple of years. But yes, earlier this week on Tuesday, a Mexican man died from a fall off the border wall.
And Gustavo's reporting on that has been really stellar. For me, it was eye-opening to learn just how much those injuries have not only increased in number, but as you said, increased in severity. Seeing his reporting develop on that has been really important in terms of just looking at, you know, a wall is not just a wall. There is a human toll to it.
Yeah, exactly. And from one of his stories, I remember a doctor that served patients there kind of made it describe like that the injuries they were then seeing were more like car accident injuries rather than something you'd expect from someone falling off a fence. Yeah, I agree. It really kind of brings it home and has human impact, like you said.
All right. And what else are you reading this week?
KPBS's Eric Anderson had a story recently about SDG&E's nearly $1 billion profit that they released in their latest financial report, and he covered some protests there. This is Essie Baradar, who attended the protest.
I've heard what they do. They don't do anything for San Diego. They only profit, profit, profit.
So, you know, I don't think this is breaking news for San Diegans, but we all know that electricity prices are amongst the highest in the nation. And I think this was just seeing like a reaction to the profits that Sempra, which owns SDG&E, it gets always a big response when we hear about these profits. And this was $23 million more than last year's profits. So it's just getting a lot of attention and pushback, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, people are seeing their electricity bills go up. There have been talks about, and we've talked about this before, the potential fixed rate charge that could be tacked on to some people's electricity bills. And so they're saying, okay, you know, this company, are they hurting? It doesn't look like it clearly if they're making this sort of profit. So when people see that profit and try to square it with how their energy bills have gone up, I think it's a head scratcher for a lot of people in San Diego.
Yeah, and I think we'll kind of have to dig into this more. And, you know, hopefully we can have Eric on roundtable again soon to talk more about the pricing changes potentially and, yeah, what's behind the finances here.
All right, so surging electricity prices. Where else are prices surging?
Well, so this was a story that, you know, it's not a San Diego story specifically, but a story from the Associated Press is where I saw it. But this effort that fast food giant Wendy's is taking to implement the surge pricing. And I think we're familiar with that. Anybody that's ridden in an Uber or Lyft, you know, sometime you'll check a ride and it'll be $15. And then 10 minutes later, it'll be up to $45. The surge pricing, you know, kind of changes based on demand. Well, the CEO of Wendy's kind of made this announcement that they were going to try to start experimenting with this idea of surge pricing as early as next year, as well as some other kind of, you know, technical advancements. But it sounds like that may not be happening now.
I think there was quite a bit of backlash to this. I mean, this, my understanding, was discussed by the CEO of Wendy's, and, you know, the public heard about this and, you know, just kind of flipped out, I think, or at least a lot of people had some strong takes about, you know, walking into a Wendy's and I guess seeing some sort of digital board showing that a burger could be jumping up or down depending on demand. Is that really what we need? What is your take on this? Let me hear it.
I just think it's interesting, this surge pricing. We've become used to it in certain aspects, like the Uber and Lyft thing, which can vary quite a bit. And also like tickets. I don't know if you've ever seen it with ticket prices or going to a sporting event. It varies wildly. I think it's hilarious because, yeah, people were just like putting up, you know, memes about hamburger prices and stuff in retaliation to this. But I do expect to see more of these experiments in other sort of ways, products and stuff. I'm not shocked by it, I guess.
Well, I think if they're going to do it, I think they should go all in. Like, make this like the trading floor on the New York Stock Exchange. Like, I want to be able to walk into a Wendy's and like short the nuggets and see the price drop for like a 10-piece and, you know, make a healthy sum from it. I want to be able to tell my kid in the future that I paid for his college because I timed the Baconator market right.
I definitely have now. I'm like having memories of trying to time an Uber ride and being like, oh, if I order it right now, or should I wait? Will it go down? I mean, I've definitely like played with that over a period of minutes. I don't know how much money I've saved, but it is a weird concept. So, you know, it's nice to hear that they're maybe backing off that for now, at least.
We'll see if they return to it. I'm going to stick with the fast food theme. There's been a lot of noise out of Sacramento in recent days about the fast food law that's about to go into effect that will raise the minimum wage for fast food workers. And it's not so much the law itself that's been getting attention, but a report from Bloomberg that highlighted the fact that restaurants that bake their own bread will be exempt from it. And that includes restaurants like Panera Bread. And Bloomberg found that one close associate of Governor Gavin Newsom, who has donated over $150,000 to Newsom's campaigns in recent years, owns two dozen Panera Breads. And the reporting from Bloomberg has suggested that there may have been some influence from this associate on this little carve out. And so, I don't know, I saw this and I said, man, you know, it should be noted Newsom's office has said that, you know, there's been nothing wrong here. There's been no wrongdoing. And there was a lot of negotiations happening with this law. But it does go to show, I mean, this is something that I think a lot of people will look at and say, you know, even if there's no wrongdoing here, people have questions about it. And there's an appearance of, was there someone who may have influenced this? What are your thoughts on it?
Well, I mean, I do think it's interesting. One of my memories is that over the pandemic, the French Laundry incident that I think got a lot of attention because I believe he was eating with some lobbyists.
Correct. Right? Yes.
I mean, so it'll be interesting to see where it goes and, you know, how the governor responds. I think my question would be more to you. I mean, you covered state politics. You covered the governor quite a bit. What would be your first question to him in the next press conference if you were still up in Sacramento covering that?
What conversations was he having with this associate while this law was being hammered out? When the negotiations were happening, what sort of conversation did he have with this person? And I will note, I covered stories very closely related to this type of thing when I was in Sacramento. You know, during COVID, I had a whole series of stories that looked at how Newsom's office had awarded no-bid contracts to large companies, mostly healthcare companies, at a time when we were in an emergency and they needed to get contracts out quickly to get things like vaccines and tests, et cetera. But I took a look at those contracts and found that some of the big dollar contracts overlapped with big dollar contributors to Newsom and Newsom's campaigns, and those contributions were coming both before and after the contracts are being handed out. And again, Newsom's office said, look, there's nothing, there's no wrongdoing here. And experts I spoke to said, look, there is no indication that any laws have been broken. It does raise questions for voters about, you know, the integrity of their politicians, their elected officials. So this is something where I've seen a bit of a pattern of this, where people are raising questions around who's getting what treatment in Sacramento. All right, let's jump to the next story now. What else are you following, Andrew? Anything else on your reading list this week?
In a little bit lighter note, this bioluminescence that sometimes comes in our coast that you can see at night, certain beaches, that's been sighted over the last few nights, so that might be worth checking out this weekend. There have been sightings at Torrey Pines and Carlsbad, Mission Bay, I think, as well. And that's, you know, happens a couple times a year here in San Diego. I don't know if you've seen it, but, you know, these like batches of plankton kind of mix with the waves and it kind of adds this cool, colorful effect. So it's worth checking out.
Oh, it's awesome. Yeah, I've seen it. I live in Pacific Beach and it's remarkable. I didn't quite know the science behind it when I first saw it. And then as I learned more, like you said, the plankton that causes it, it's fascinating. But it is really cool to check out. Definitely recommend going down there. I'll round it out with a story that really caught my attention this week. It was from NPR. It's a pretty wild investigation. The headline is, a tech billionaire is quietly buying up land in Hawaii. No one knows why. And that billionaire is Mark Benioff. He's the owner of Salesforce. He's been buying up a ton of land on Hawaii around Waimea. And a reporter from NPR got in touch with Benioff, and they had some interviews, some conversations. A lot of this land purchase was anonymous. You know, Benioff said he didn't want attention. He touted a lot of the philanthropy that he had done around the island. And, you know, he has done a lot, and he's donated a lot of this land. But as the reporter kept digging and found some holding companies, that's when this story got kind of dark. And Benioff had said he was tracking the reporter in one of their exchanges. He knew exactly where she was. And, you know, he said, basically, it's my job to track you. And he started prodding other NPR reporters and the NPR CEO for more intel. And it just really struck me as, you know, this was beyond just a story looking into who owns or who's buying up a lot of land in a place. But the response that someone so powerful would have to this type of reporting and someone just asking questions.
This is pretty disturbing. I didn't know about this, especially the sort of tracking of the reporter. Has there been a response from Benioff?
You know, there was a lot of the responses of Benioff in terms of the purchasing of the land and the story itself. There was follow-up coverage of this story. I've not seen any comments specifically from Benioff about that aspect of it. But again, you know, Benioff's camp has said a lot of this land purchase is for good reason. You know, it's for philanthropic purposes. A lot of it will also be used for their family. They said they like their privacy. But yeah, that tracking aspect of it, the kind of, menacing aspect of approaching or trying to confront a reporter in that way when they're simply just trying to figure out what a situation is. Yeah, it gives me goosebumps.
Yeah, that's definitely disturbing. I mean, in another way, it does remind me of these land purchases that are going on in a part of Northern California, probably closer to where
just outside of the Bay Area.
Yeah, and I think it was, you know, Mark Andreessen, or maybe it's not even clear, but some very wealthy tech folks from the Bay Area are kind of potentially looking to build a city from scratch was the sort of what I understood.
Yeah, they were buying up a lot of land. It was around Travis Air Base, and it was Mark Andreessen and some others as well, some other investors. And it raised a lot of concern because at first there was just an LLC that was behind the purchases, and there was a lot of concern about who may be purchasing all this land around this airbase. And there was concern that it might have been, a foreign country or someone who didn't have the best interests of the United States in mind. And after some reporting, I believe it was the New York Times that uncovered that it was, in fact, an LLC that was led by these, you know, these sort of tech titans. But their plan is to try to essentially build a utopian sort of city from scratch, and they're trying to put this on the ballot. And from what I can tell, voters are a bit hesitant about it. You know, there is a big pitch here. The idea of trying to build a city from scratch in a place like California is such a tall order and so many unknowns, so many regulations. But it does speak to, I mean, when there are these purchases, mass purchases of land by kind of unknown folks, and even when it becomes clear from wealthy folks, yeah, it leaves people a bit unnerved.
Yeah, and just the amount of power, the amount of money we're talking about is, I don't know, it's like it's even hard to relate to. I mean, I guess it makes, in some ways, Mark Zuckerberg attending a UFC fight look a little tame by comparison. I don't know if you saw that.
I did, yeah. But on the Hawaii front, I'm sure there will be follow-up reporting on not only what happens with that land, but, you know, response to and from Mark Benioff. So I'll definitely be keeping an eye on that. That investigation on NPR.org, definitely worth checking out. Andrew Bracken, thanks for being here and for joining me on the Roundup.
Thanks, Scott.
Thanks for tuning in to KPBS Roundtable. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at roundtable@kpbs.org or leave us a message at 619-452-0228. You can also listen to our show anytime as a podcast. KPBS Roundtable airs on KPBS FM at noon on Fridays and again Sundays at 6 a.m. Roundtable is produced by Andrew Bracken. Brandon Trufa is our technical producer. Brooke Ruth is our senior producer. And I'm Scott Rodd. Thanks for listening.